Newly released video reveals Russian military interception of a U.S. surveillance drone as the U.S. Defense Secretary makes one thing clear to his Russian counterpart.
The United States will fly and operate wherever international law allows.
Plus, war crimes, indiscriminate attacks on infrastructure, systematic and widespread torture. A UN report on possible Russian human rights abuses and violations of international humanitarian law.
The findings, I must say, are pretty devastating.
And later in the program, a Ukrainian family who fled to Poland and opened a restaurant called Crimea in front of the Russian embassy in Warsaw. Today is Thursday, March 16th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. The U.S. military on Thursday released footage of what it says was a Russian aircraft spraying fuel on a U.S. Air Force surveillance drone and clipping its propeller in international airspace over the Black Sea on Tuesday. While intercepts between Russia and NATO member countries are common, this is the first time since the Cold War that a U.S. aircraft went down during such a confrontation, raising fears of escalation. Meanwhile, a day after the Russian fighter jet struck the propeller of the U.S. military unmanned drone, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke to his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington reports it was one of the few such calls since Russia invaded Ukraine more than a year ago.
Defense Secretary Austin says it was key that someone in Moscow answered his call. During the early months after Russia invaded Ukraine, Russian officials refused to take such calls from the U.S. military. Austin declined to tell reporters what he said to Shoigu, but made clear to the journalists at the Pentagon,
"The United States will fly and operate wherever international law allows."
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, alongside Austin, called the Black Sea incident an aggressive act, part of a pattern of recent Russian behavior. But the United States is not looking to escalate tensions.
Incidents happen, clearly we do not seek armed conflict with Russia.
The remote-controlled U.S. Air Force MQ-9 Reaper was ditched in the sea after the Russian fighter jet struck its propeller. Moscow denies causing the incident. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
As U.S. military officials and lawmakers debate the merits of whether or not to send F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, Poland will be the first NATO member to send this type of aircraft. I spoke with Anna Chernikova, reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Anna, I hear there is some pretty big news.
Yeah, so the main news for today, actually, the president of Poland, Mr. Duda, has confirmed that Poland is giving Ukraine four MiG aircrafts, and that this is happening very, very soon. It's basically, according to him, what he said in his during press conference that he had today with President of Czech Republic. He said that these four aircrafts are already on the way. They are ready to be used. They have gone through all the needed service and all the needed procedures. He also confirmed that more aircrafts are under the preparation to be sent to Ukraine. He did not specify the exact amount, but he mentioned that there are dozens of such kind of aircraft that Poland has in its capacity. So basically, this aircraft is something that Ukraine was asking for, in line with modern aircrafts as well. But MiG aircrafts is something that Ukrainian pilots used to and that Ukrainian army also used. So this is Soviet-type aircrafts. And basically, Ukrainians do not need training to use this. This is fighter aircraft, so basically Soviet military fighter aircraft that both Poland and Ukraine has in their capacity. And since the beginning of full-scale invasion, Ukraine was actually asking its allies who have such aircrafts to provide them to Ukraine because, as I already mentioned, Ukrainians have experience in using this.
And what is the latest on the ground? I know that the fierce battle in Bakhmut is continuing. Any updates on that or elsewhere?
So this news, aircraft news from Poland, is basically goes in line with generally Ukrainian preparation for this counteroffensive, which is supposed to start, according to Ukrainian military, sometime in spring, either April or end of March or May. So we don't have exact dates, but somewhere in spring. So this is something that Ukrainian military and Ukrainian authorities concentrate on right now. So this is the preparation, and Bakhmut is definitely the hottest spot, remaining the hottest spot, which saves time for Ukrainian military to prepare for this counteroffensive. For the moment, what we know that extremely difficult fighting continue, and Ukrainian military continue to control the central part of the city of Bakhmut. However, Russian Wagner Group had certain advances inside the city, but according to official data and according to official updates that we have, but of course we cannot verify independently, it's according to Ukrainian military, a central part remains under Ukrainian control. There are also some tries by Russian military, particularly Russian army, which is separately from Wagner Group, to get some advance next to the city of Vuhledar, which is also in the same area. But for the moment, there are official reports that Ukrainians managed to keep the positions and Russian forces did not have success in that area. So what we're also hearing that attacks are happening all the time and Russian forces are trying to advance every day, every hour even. But again, for the moment, there are no much updates on the front line changes.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. The UN Human Rights Council commission tasked with investigating possible Russian human rights abuses and violations of international humanitarian law has released a report on its findings. VOA's Steve Karish got an update from Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
So we know the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine just presented its first report on the situation in Ukraine at a press conference in Geneva. Our reporter in Geneva, Lisa Schlein, was there. Lisa, what can you tell us?
The findings, I must say, are pretty devastating. There's this kind of breathtaking scale and scope of alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity, which the commission says has been committed, and it makes a pretty effective case in terms of what it is that they have done. For instance, they talk about war crimes that include attacks on energy infrastructure. They also spoke about summary executions, unlawful confinement in areas under their control. And what happened there was there were a lot of cases of sexual and gender-based violence, as well as people being tortured while in confinement. And another thing, among many others that they mentioned, was the unlawful transfers and deportations of children from Ukraine to Russia. And in many cases, these children were adopted by Russian families, and they were given Russian citizenship in an effort, in a sense, to erase their cultural heritage.
Is the commission prepared, or is the commission even allowed to do anything about it?
Well, by publicizing this, it presents a case for further investigations. And one of the things they are doing is they are collecting names, identifying names of people who are individually responsible and should be held accountable for many of these crimes which have been committed. They are asking for international tribunals to investigate many of these crimes.
There have been allegations, though not as many, of war crimes committed by Ukrainian forces against Russian soldiers and POWs. Did the report mention that at all?
The commission did mention this. They say that Ukrainian armed forces were responsible in a limited number of cases of committing violations which might amount to war crimes. And what they mentioned was the use of cluster bombs, which are in fact prohibited under international international law, as well as there were two incidents of cases of shootings and torture by Ukrainian personnel, armed forces, against Russian POWs, and that also would amount to a war crime.
Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. Lisa, thanks for your time today. Thanks for bringing this information to us.
Thank you, Steve.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the challenge posed by China prompted Britain to publish an updated defense strategy this week as the country tries to balance strategic threats with financial constraints at home. Henry Ridgewell reports to us from London.
Britain's so-called integrated review refresh says Russia's invasion of Ukraine means the West's collective security is now intrinsically linked to the outcome of the conflict.
It's forced the UK to acknowledge that our most immediate threats come much closer to home, and actually that the UK is in a really strong position, as the last year has shown, to provide military support to allies in Europe, particularly on Europe's Eastern Front.
On top of Britain's $58 billion annual defence spending, the review commits an additional $6 billion over the next 2 years. Of that, $2.3 billion will be spent on replenishing ammunition stocks that have been depleted through military aid given to Ukraine. The review reiterated Britain's ambition to increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP, but the target of meeting that goal by 2030 has been removed.
If the UK really wants to be global Britain, wants to be a force on the world stage, wants to be at the front of the pack when it comes to responding to Russia or to China, then we need more money to do that. At the moment, we're trying to run a first-rate military, which is up there competing with, you know, the US and China and Russia on a second-rate economy, because we're lagging behind many other of our peers at the moment.
Britain's posture toward China has gained much attention. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said China poses an epoch-defining challenge.
It's a country with fundamentally different values to ours, and its behaviour over the past few years has been concerning. More authoritarian at home, more assertive overseas.
But Sunak stopped short of labelling China a threat, despite pressure from some in his party.
That China's policy can change. And no one knows whether or not China will invade Taiwan, whether or not China will continue down this more assertive path. So I think the UK government wants to keep its options open. And I think the UK also recognises that China will be an important country to work with on addressing global challenges.
An additional $3.6 billion will be spent to support the delivery of nuclear-powered submarines for the Australian Navy as part of the AUKUS Indo-Pacific Defence Pact with the US and Australia. Beijing said the deal put the region on a dangerous path. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Some 2 million Ukrainian children have been displaced by the war. For those forced to leave and those still in Ukraine, the war can have severe psychological impacts. But a simple therapeutic tool is helping some kids cope. Anna Kostuchenko has the story, narrated by Steve Baragona.
Anya is 9, and since day one of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, she has been in Kyiv with her parents, who did not give their last name. Shelling and air raid sirens are part of her daily life.
We boarded windows after two rockets landed 600 meters from our apartment building.
Their mother says she can see how the war is affecting Anya and her two sisters.
She became somewhat withdrawn, sometimes aggressive and tense. I was constantly worried this may end up with Anya having a nervous breakdown.
But Anya is getting some help from Hibuki, a word that means hugs in Hebrew. Hibuki is a therapeutic toy invented in Israel in 2006 as a way to help children deal with stress during the 2006 Lebanon War. In April 2022, Ukrainian psychologists started giving Hibuki toys to some of the traumatized children in Ukraine. Anya's family was one of the first in Kyiv to receive it.
After 3 or 4 weeks, we saw the obvious results. Anya started to communicate with kids again, became friendly, a lot calmer.
Victoria Nazarevich was one of the first professional psychologists in Ukraine to use it during her work with kids.
So many children are traumatized. They lost their homes. They suffer from daily rocket attacks. We were trying to find something that would help them deal with trauma. And it appeared to be a toy that children can hug and interact with.
Art therapist Marina Cherkashina says Hibuki helps kids dispel stress, which is healthier than keeping it all inside. And its paws always offer a child a much-needed hug.
We call it Huggy Dog. We have kids here who have not left Kyiv since the start of the war. They were the first children to receive Hibuki.
So far, over 5,000 Ukrainians have been able to experience the therapeutic benefits of Hibuki. Thanks to the U.S. nonprofit charity, United Help Ukraine. The group funds psychology training courses explaining how to work with Hibuki.
I'm trying to look like I'm okay, but inside, I panic.
8-year-old Pablo's mother, Mariana, said Hibuki helped her son a lot.
He completely changed. We got to see our child from new angles. He's more open now.
Ukrainian psychologists have also invented a little hedgehog toy that attaches to the child's hand. In addition, psychologists here are also using art therapy to help children deal with their trauma, while Hibuki sits nearby. For Anna Kostyuchenko in Kyiv, Ukraine, Steve Baragona, VOA News.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has traumatized many children and adults in the war-torn country. Natalia Vetrova created the Ukraine Volia Foundation, a nonprofit organization that helps Ukrainian children cope. Mykhailo Komandovsky has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
A laptop and a small desk. Are all Natalia Vetrova, founder of the nonprofit called Ukraine Volia Foundation, needs to help her fellow Ukrainians. A sustainable fashion expert before the war, she now dedicates her time to helping Ukrainian children deal with war-related trauma. Her journey started at a pro-Ukraine rally in the U.S.
When I was at one of the rallies, I just realized I was at the wrong place. My desire to be with my people, with Ukrainians, was stronger than the desire to help from here. So one morning I woke up and told my husband I'm going. I got a ticket and 2 days later packed my backpack and went.
After an initial trip, she returned to Washington with a plan. She raised some funds and headed back to Lviv. 2 months later, she'd managed to equip a center for the internally displaced in Lviv. She made sure dozens of families had enough clothing, food, and attention. But soon she realized the people she cared for needed more than physical things.
The most important thing for me are children, my soft spot. At the time, no one was talking about war-related trauma. So I started this conversation and people said, "What are you talking about? There is no food, no clothing, hardly any beds, and you're talking about some psychological help."
The program she set up was devised by clinical psychologists skilled at helping children cope with all kinds of trauma, from natural disasters to violent crime and war. The program uses games as a way for adults to communicate with children about their trauma and allow them to get past it. A year into the war, Vetrova says she is seeing delayed trauma starting to show up. Natalia is looking for help everywhere, including from Ukraine's First Lady.
We should meet with Olena Zelenska. We need the government support. She was one of the first to start talking about Ukrainian children's psychological state, not just children, but everyone affected. All Ukrainians are traumatized. How can mom or dad help their kid if they themselves are traumatized?
Today, Vetrova is planning her next trip to Ukraine, where she will bring warm clothes for the children
and new methods to provide psychological help. She, like millions of others, can't wait for the war to be over, though she plans to keep offering help long after it ends. For Mikhaila Komadovsky in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
March marks the 9th anniversary of Russia's annexation of Crimea. Many in Crimea had to leave their home after Russian forces overran the peninsula. Among them, Sulamanov and his family. They fled to Warsaw, where they opened a restaurant called Crimea, right in front of the Russian embassy in Poland. For VOA from Warsaw, Lisha Bakalets has their story.
Every morning, Ernest Sulimanov's family begins with a ritual. They carry three flags, the Crimean Tatar, the Ukrainian, and the Polish, and hang them at the entrance to their restaurant, precisely opposite the Russian embassy. Ernest Sulimanov is the owner of the Krim restaurant.
It makes me very happy. I can hang the flags in front of the Russians so they can see them.
The restaurant is called Krim, which means Crimea in Ukrainian. Aside from being the restaurant's owner, Ernest is a journalist and activist. He had been searching for a place for a long time.
My friend told me there is a vacant place opposite the Russian embassy. There is also a scientific center where they teach the Russian language, and I thought it would be great to troll them like that.
In the restaurant, there is the delicious smell of home-cooked food. Guests are treated to only Crimean traditional dishes. The most important are chabureks, fried turnovers with different fillings. Elmira Seitakhmetova is also an owner of the Krim.
There is no secret recipe, just meat, onion, pepper, and salt. And you need to add a little water. My mother always made chabureki. She said it was quick to prepare. So when guests come, you can cook chabureki while they are drinking coffee.
Elmira's mother also taught her that their real home is not Uzbekistan, where the family was deported during World War II, but Crimea.
The motherland is the best place there can be.
Ernest was also born and raised in Tashkent. His parents were deported when they were children. Both families, Ernest's and Elmira's, could return home to Crimea only after Ukraine got its independence. But in March 2014, when Russia seized Crimea, the couple had to flee again. It was dangerous for the family of Ernest, who had already been an activist of what was known as the Revolution of Dignity, to stay in Crimea.
I last remember standing on Kuibyshev Square in Simferopol, giving an interview. I saw people in camouflage following me. I managed to escape. At that time, my photos with the sign WANTED were on the poles all over Simferopol. My friends convinced me to leave and bought a ticket for the train. Those were the last trains that went from Crimea to Ukraine. I didn't take anything with me.
It was the last time Ernest saw Crimea and his relatives. First, the family moved to Kyiv, then to Warsaw, when their son entered the local university. For the family, Poland has been a second home for a long time. Ernest and Elmira once studied here. But Elmira says she still misses her homeland, and having the restaurant helps with those feelings.
Most of all, I miss the Crimean mountains and the smell of Crimean herbs. That is why we prepare Crimean tea here, with herbs we buy in Greece. They are the same as in Crimea. When we drink this tea, we feel like we are in the motherland.
Ernest and his family say they dream about when they could return to free and Ukrainian Crimea. Lesia Bakalets for VOA News, Warsaw.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
This is the voice. of America. Washington, D.C.